And now it's time for Power of Prophecy with your host, former professor at the University of Texas at Austin, career United States Air Force officer, and best-selling author, Tex Mars.
Hello, friends. This is Tex Mars. Welcome to another edition of Power of Prophecy. And today we're going to have an incredible time of truth. You know, I've got a book right here in front of me. It's entitled Hailstorm. All one word now. Hailstorm. H-E-L-L-S-T-O-R-M. The subtitle is quite interesting. It's The Death of Nazi Germany, 1944 to 1947. And it's by a man I'm going to introduce you to in just a moment named Thomas Goodrich. Tom Goodrich. From Florida. Now, this is just an incredible book. I sort of stumbled onto it. I was going over Amazon.com, some other books, and this one just sort of popped up, and I ordered it, and just an excellent book. Now, the thing about this book that gets your attention is the subtitle, The Death of Nazi Germany, 1944 to 47. Now, that was the time, let's say 1945 to 47, when Nazi Germany had died and we had the birth of a democracy, of a freedom, I mean, a free Germany. And I'm just telling you what the conventional view is. I mean, isn't that what you read in your textbooks in school? Isn't that what you saw on television when all those Hollywood movies? I mean, with never-ending movies. I mean, in my childhood, there must have been 500 movies. I'm probably exaggerating, but about that many. All kinds of movies. And, of course, all of them have the evil, evil, wicked, plotting, terrible, dummy Nazis versus the clever, intelligent, kind, resourceful, compassionate Americans. And it was assumed that our allies would join us in that, you know, the British, and to some extent the French and the Russians, of course. They were our ally, Joseph Stalin and so forth. And we were told that the allies, the Germans, Russians and the Americans and the British were so compassionate that we cared so much about the German people. And immediately after they surrendered, in an unconditional surrender, we immediately gave them everything we had, all the food we had. We helped them build back their economy. And about a decade later, they call it the miracle, the economic miracle. We had built back Germany into a great nation. And it was all because we loved the German people so much. We knew it was only that small little group called the Nazis. But as far as the Germans themselves goes, we loved them. We took them in. And of course, we cleaned out those Nazis at Nuremberg and all that, those evil, dirty Nazis. And we put in freedom-loving, democracy-enjoying Germans. So the minute the surrender came forward, then the glory days of heaven, you know, I mean, clouds dissipated and wonderful days were ahead for the Germans. And everybody was smiling and loving and welcomed and It was a great, great time of victory for the German people who themselves were plundered and hated and despised and done terrible by the small group of evil Nazis. That's what I thought was true. But in recent years, there have been books coming out, truthful books. And it seems that these books all tell a different story. All of the establishment books have come out, over 1,000 maybe, hundreds of movies. And all the documentaries I've seen, Walter Cronkite, you know, The World at War and all those on TV, and they all told about the evil Nazis and how we kicked them in the back end, and boy, now the Germans have it made. Why does this gentleman, Thomas Goodrich, subtitle his book, The Death of Nazi Germany from 44 to 47. What was dying then? I thought they were awake. I thought they were alive. I thought it was a miracle. And we were responsible for it. It was our money, our food, our economic aid that helped Germany recover. That's what all our newspapers said, all our books, all our movies, everything we're told. And after all, America is a free country. We don't have any propaganda here. We have a free press. I mean, going all the way back to, 1780-something, and Mr. Zinger there in Pennsylvania, and all we were, a principle of a free press. Well, Mr. Goodrich has done some studying, and he confirms many books before his, but I'll tell you, I believe his book is the best. It's the one book we're offering on the subject, because it doesn't have propaganda in it, unless you're one of those strange people that categorize the truth as propaganda. Tom Goodrich, welcome to Power of Prophecy.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Tech. It's my pleasure.
Well, what about this? You know, I'm reading an issue of a journal called the Journal of Social, Political, and Economic Studies, spring 2009. It says there are a lot of what we would call revisionist books looking at Germany after the war. And it seems like we've been lied to. What is the truth, Mr. Goodrich? What happened here?
Well, I'm like I said earlier when you and I were talking before we came on. You and I have roughly the same carbon dating, I think. So we both grew up with a steady diet of the good war scenario. We were used to the scenes of good-natured GIs sitting on Sherman tanks. As they roll through Germany, they're chewing their gum and throwing Hershey bars to the kids by the sides of the roads. And that's sort of the image that's been purveyed to us. It's the good war scenario. And, well, first of all, let me say that there's no such thing as a good war. They're all bad. War is terrible by its very nature. But to call this abomination, this atrocity that was World War II, a good war, well, only Studs Terkel and his Jewish tribe consider World War II a good war, because, of course, they were the only ones that benefited from that war. I assure you that the European tribe and the American tribe and the Canadian tribe and the United Kingdom tribe, we didn't win that war. We lost it. So it was not a good war. In fact, it was the world's worst war, and it was also the world's worst so-called peace. Peace. Actually, war by other means was the peace of World War II. You know, Tex, there's that old saying, and everybody listening has heard it, about if you don't learn from your history, you're doomed to repeat your history. And I think that's fairly true, but you cannot learn from your history if you don't know of any history, if the history has not been printed, has not been published. And yes, it's true. My book is the first, and as far as I know, the only book that talks about the crimes committed in World War II. This is not a book about what the Germans did to the war. It's about what the world did to the Germans. It's the crimes committed in the name of democracy and a crusade in Europe, such silly terms as that. And there are other books, and very good books, by the way, that have talked about various components of World War II, the crimes that were committed, that is, against the German people. But they touch upon one or more components, but they don't touch the totality, as Hellstorm tries to do, and I think I have done it with that. The Allied terror bombing, for instance. This was not the bombing that we're accustomed to seeing in the war movies, where they're going after factories and industries and maybe armored German columns as they move through the Reich. By 1944, and that's where the date comes in on the subtitle of the book, 1944, there were no more targets in Germany available. And so this Allied terror bombing, the Americans and the British, they called it saturation bombing or carpet bombing, whatever you will. But let me assure you that the people who suffered from it, the old men, the women, and the children, the ones who were left in the cities, they knew it by its more accurate name. That was terror bombing. Terror bombing. It was put in place by the drunken Prime Minister Churchill and his man at the FDRAF, at the RAF, Royal Air Force, that is, Bomber Harris, they called him appropriately. And it was basically an attempt to kill every man, woman, and child down below. In other words, let me give you an example of a terror bombing raid. Let's start with Hamburg. That's how I start in the movie. Let's say 1,000 planes roar in some night. They've only basically dusted off this town. They haven't really destroyed it to as far as they might have. but they roar in 1,000 planes and drop high explosives and just blast Hamburg to splinters, just blow it to bits, this beautiful, former medieval, beautiful town. And then while the people are crawling out of their air raid shelters, those who survived, and while the Red Cross workers are coming in, and while the ambulances are trying to take away the wounded and the dead and the dying, in comes another 1,000 planes. This time they come in with phosphorus bombs, napalm, and drop that down on the splinters that was once Hamburg. Well, what happens was, as we found out in Hamburg, the fires all over the city join to create a huge flaming mass in the middle of the city. Eventually the heat gets up to 1,500 degrees. It creates its own suction. You have hurricane-force winds. You have a vortex, literally a tornado of fire rising 3 miles into the sky. And the people on the ground who are trying to get away from this are actually sucked into this swirling tornado of fire. Those who are not drawn into it are actually stuck in the asphalt, cannot move, and of course then very quickly they burst into flames. It uproots trees. It tears off roofs. It drags trolley cars into it. That is a terror bombing. That's an attempt, a deliberate attempt, a concerted effort to destroy every man, woman, and child in Germany. And this was just Hamburg. I think some of your listeners have probably heard of the most famous, of course, and that's Dresden, because it's been written about. But it occurred to virtually every German city, over roughly 25,000 population. This is 1944. The war is lost. Germany's going to lose this war. The Allies know it. Germany knows it. So there is no point for this except to kill as many people as possible. That pretty well describes what the war is like now in 1944 and 1945. And while we're on the subject, yes, let me say that the reason I titled it 1944 to 1947, because, of course, the war did not end in 1945, the war against Germany. It went on. This idea of Americans good-naturedly, or the British, wanting to welcome Germany back into the Brotherhood of Nations. Yes, true, they, as Nazis, they had erred, had gone off the beaten path, but now they're being welcomed back in to the nations of the world. That's a lie. Germany was punished. In fact, Germany's being punished to this very day, as we all know. But especially in those first two post-war years that I talk about. As mentioned, though, I do talk about the last year of the war. For instance, here's things that are never, ever mentioned when we talk about World War II. Not just the terror bombing, not just the attempt to flash-fry everybody below, but I'm willing to wager that your listeners probably think the world's worst nautical disaster was either the Titanic, in which 1,500 people died, or the Lusitania. Both of those ships sinking, of course, were terrible events. And I don't mean to make light of either one of them. I think the Lusitania, 1,200 people went down with the ship, and that's awful. But they have received so much play that everyone automatically thinks that these were the worst disasters, nautical disasters, that is, in world history. Not so, not even close. In fact, in the book, I talk about refugees, women and children, mostly women and children and old people, trying to escape the Soviet advance in the eastern part of Germany, Prussia, Pomerania, those places. And with the land cut off, with the Soviet tanks moving through, the only way out of there is to get on ships and cross the Baltic back over to western Germany. Old ships, new ships, freighters, old cruise liners, people getting on board of these things, desperate. They're carrying their sacks. It's in the depths of winter, too, by the way. Minus 20 degrees some nights. And so they're desperate to escape the Soviet advance, which I'll talk about in just a second. But, for instance, the Wilhelm Gustloff. I don't know how many of your listeners have heard that name, but this former cruise liner put on anywhere from 8,000 to 10,000 people. It was a ship meant to hold 2,000, by the way, including crew. A ship meant or built for 2,000 people. Suddenly, with anywhere from 8,000 to 10,000 refugees, as they pull away from port, headed towards western Germany, trying to reach safety with these people. You can imagine what a night of horror that had to be as soon as they set sail. Everything went down, of course. You've got 10,000 people using the toilets, and those things back up, and you've got this hideous smell throughout the ship of closed windows, of course, of excrement and urine and vomit, of course. The seas were very rough and full of ice. Well, things got worse in a hurry. It was attacked by a submarine who knew very well that it was a refugee ship. There were no large German naval vessels floating on the Baltic by 1944 and 45. And so, with two torpedoes in the side, the Gustloff sank, and although there's still some debate on how many died, I can safely say at least 7,000 died, and perhaps as many as 9,000 died.
This was a German ship.
Alone.
This was a German ship of people desperate to get out of East Germany because of the horrible disaster of the Russian advance, military advance, and it was torpedoed in the knowledge that there were all of these poor people, men, women, children, babies, by who, British or American submarines?
These were Russian submarines, but the American bombers, the air bombers, the airplanes and British, they did the same thing. They attacked them as soon as they got into port, would bomb these. In fact, one ship just docked. I believe it was called the Cap Arcona, had just docked in a western port, western German port, tied up. And an American bomb hit it right in the middle and sank it right there in the slip. And 2,000 women and children died right there. So it was a massacre on the Baltic. The Wilhelm Gustloff was just the worst, but there were 7,000 in another ship that went down, 5,000 in another. And this was, yes, it was deliberate. There was, as I said, there was no large German surface vessels at this late stage of the war. They were either all sunk or in their ports. But the reason these people were fleeing and so desperate to get away was because of the Russians, of course. And the Russians were coming through. Let me say this, that what happened on the Eastern Front, it's like from the pages of hell. If you had to read a book on hell, this would be it. The Russians came through, and, of course, they had chased the Germans out of Russia, where a lot of the fighting had taken place at Stalingrad and Moscow and Leningrad, places like that. And so the Russians were bent on punishing Germany. But it was things like this. Ilya Ehrenberg, the Jewish propagandist for Stalin, it wasn't enough that the average Russian already wanted revenge, but this man had to toss the extra shovels full of coal onto the fire. Here's a typical comment by Ehrenberg. What he would do was he would write these screeds, these impassioned encouragements for the Red soldier to do his dead level worst when he got into Germany. Here's one, just as this Red Army was ready to break into Germany. It said, "Kill them all, the men, old men, children, and the women, after you have amused yourself with them. Kill. Nothing in Germany is guiltless, neither the living nor the yet unborn. Break the racial pride of the German women. Take her as your legitimate booty. Kill, you brave soldiers of the victorious Soviet Army. Kill." Now, this is coming from a sanctioned member of Stalin's government, someone who is esteemed by Stalin, who's probably the most influential writer in Russia at the time, this Jew, Ilya Ehrenberg. Now, what do you think is the typical unsophisticated Soviet country boy is going to think when he reads this? He's going to think that, yes, he's got carte blanche to do anything he wants once he gets into Germany. He can loot, he can plunder, he can kill, and above all, he can rape and kill some more. That's the message being sent, and let me say this, many, many of them lived up to that with aces and spades. But let me also make one note here on that. As I found out, this entire book was a revelation to me, Tex, quite honestly. I knew very little about it, and so I'm as amazed as the readers are when they read this thing. One thing I found out was that the frontline Russian soldiers, as they were coming through, were by and large, well, first and foremost, they were very tough individuals. They were frontline soldiers, shock troops, they called them. But the majority of them were white Russians. That is, they came from white Russia. They came from Ukraine. They came from Belarus, places like that. Very tough guys. Now, as all frontline troops do, they can be pretty tough people. Let me say that they can loot, and kill, and plunder, and commit crimes with the best of them. But for the most part, a frontline soldier's way too busy trying to stay alive, dodging from door to door, kicking in windows to make sure the Germans were gone or hopefully gone. Nobody really wanted to fight, but he was more concerned about staying alive to get back home to that cute little girl back in Babushkaville in Russia. And so the crimes that were committed, by and large, were from the second echelon, the rear echelon, the supply side that came in right behind the shock troops, the ones that were driving the trucks full of equipment, the ones that were actually herding the sheep and the cattle. That's their food on the hoof, so to speak, Russian army. These were composed largely of Asiatics, Mongols, Kazakhs, people from the Asiatic province or republics of Russia. And they had the worst reputation of all. In fact, many times a Russian officer with the shock troops, the front troops, frontline troops, would warn the people, actually tell the folks in the villages to get out and get out quick because we're tough guys and we do a lot of bad things too. But the ones behind us are nothing but animals. These people, they're the worst in the army. Please go, get out. Of course, many folks couldn't leave by that late stage. And so, but anyway, when the Mongolians and the Asiatics finally hit town, well, hell was released on earth, quite honestly. There was an immediate orgy of killing, and there was a hunt for anything that could be drank, everything from fine cognac down to gasoline. They would drink anything to get nuts, crazy. And then the rapes that were just off the charts. And to make a long story short, millions of German women were raped millions of times. And throughout the book, even towards the later part of the chapters, even during so-called peace, the rape continues. And I mention this because I think it's very important for people to understand that this was a deliberate attempt. It was a spiritual massacre of German womanhood. It was a deliberate, contrived attempt to destroy them. If they weren't killed, they would be useless. Let's put it this way. The second echelon, this rear echelon of Asiatics, roll into your village, and you're a clerk at a grocery store, and they drag you out, 30, 40, 50 men, 100 men, and they rape you right on the street, broad daylight. People can see this going on as they stand in line laughing for their turn. How do you get back to normal? How do you stay a month or a year later? How do you go back being a clerk in that grocery store? You don't, because if you were lucky enough to survive, you've lost all respect for yourself. You feel like you've never felt this low in your life before. You're afraid to even show your face. It was so horrible. Or if you're a school teacher, if you're a school teacher in a village or a city and the Russians come through, and you didn't believe all the propaganda that Joseph Goebbels had said, the Russians were, especially the Asiatics, were rapists and beasts. Let's just say you didn't, and you stuck around, and they grab you, and they take you out in the playground, and all the kids are forced to come out too and watch as an entire line of men force you, the school teacher, the lady school teacher, to give them oral sex all day. How do you get back to being a school teacher? How do you get on with your life later? You don't. And that's what I mean by the spiritual massacre of German women. Now, this transcends anything I had ever heard of in my life. Time and time again, this is not an anomaly. This is not something, an aberration that happened once or twice, and I'm just putting a spotlight on. This happens all the time, everywhere, up and down Germany. In fact, one of the most sickening, the age group was from 8 to 80. That was the joke. Anybody, any girl from 8 to 80 could expect to be raped. And actually, the ages shifted quite a bit. You could be 6 years old, or you could be 90 years old, and you would still be raped. It was a deliberate attempt to destroy Germany. And it pretty well succeeded, quite honestly, that part of it. What can you say about anybody, any people, that would actually stand in line laughing in broad daylight to rape a corpse and laughing about it and standing in line and going? And then finally, when I suppose when the corpse got as stiff as a board, as a tree limb, and somebody stuck a rock or a bar or a telephone receiver up her vagina, meaning closed for business, then they would move on to someone else. And that's what I mean. It was a plague unlike anything ever happened to Europe. And this went on all the way to Berlin and to the end of the war, and then it continued even after that, far beyond that, as a matter of fact. But no one that I had ever read before had ever even come close to describing what happened to the German females, children, and women. And if you were a man, if you were one of the few men left behind, generally you were an old man, if you dared try to protect a woman, you would be probably castrated and killed right there on the spots. it seems that time and time again, anyone who tried to protect women were actually sawn in half, and I assume with bayonets. But that seemed to be the methodology, to just saw the man in half. Early up in the book, when I talk about when the Russians first crossed into Germany, there were 50 French and Polish workers that were, as they did during the war, working for Germany, growing crops, hauling junk, whatever they did. But they tried to stop the rapes. They tried to stop what they considered to be one of the greatest crimes of all, and that's the rape of a woman, a helpless woman. Well, they were all killed. The Russians killed them all. Now, the only thing that can... let me say this. When you've got a Jewish commissar, and most units above the company level had a Jewish commissar, which was a political officer who's traveling along with the men to make sure they're good little communists, that they hate Germans and that they do bad things, that the Germans kill them and rape the women. When you've got this guy that will blow your brains out if you disobey him, even if your heart is not into it, then, you're still looking out for number one, yourself. And so when these guys, for instance, one of the first places, if you're a woman in a village, you would think that a church would be a haven, a safe haven. And that's generally where most women and girls ran to when they heard that the rear echelon, or the second echelon of the Asiatics, had rolled into town. They tried to seek sanctuary in a church. Well, the Jewish commissars, of course, they knew this. They knew that that would be the first place these good Lutherans would go to. And that's, of course, where they sent their men. The first place they would send their men would be the churches. And then with the bells ringing and the organs playing, they would rape for days. Just for however long the troops were there, they would rape. And not just the women and children. They would rape the nuns over and over. They loved doing that. It was, I think I've pretty well talked that out. It's so beastly text that, in fact, right now I'm kind of working on a book on the side. It's got something to do with war and rape, because I've written about this before. It has generally, I never set off to write books on rape. They just happen in war, and that's another terrible aspect of war, is rape. A lot of folks don't have...
You know, Tom, I've been listening to you here, and the spiritual element, the spiritual, that really hit a chord.
Yeah.
And it seems to me, I read in your book, I'm on page 79, you get into graphic detail, and it's not a book that is going to get anybody all lurid and lustful. It's a book of facts, of, as if you were reading from a trial transcript. It's just incredible. I'm reading here, it says, "There was never a moment's peace, either by day or at night. The Russians were coming and going the whole time. The nights were dreadful. We were never safe for a minute. The women were raped not once or twice, but 10, 20, 30, 100 times. And it was all the same to the Russians, whether they raped children or old women. The youngest victim in the row houses where we live was 10 years of age. The oldest was over 70. And you go on and on here about the nuns, 79 years old, 80 years old. They were raped, and many of these people were killed. I mean, they were just, these weren't nice men. They raped them over and over, and many of them were raped to death. But the spiritual element, I think you're onto something. Now, it would seem to me that a book like this, feminist groups that claim to be for women, that are making all these rules on these college campuses about when to say no or yes and all this, whatever the rules are on American college campuses, it would seem like all of these women would get your book and see the importance of it, the spiritual element, even the feminist element, and say this book is important and people need to read and discover what happened in history in the so-called good war. I remember Tom Brokaw did a book, and everybody was talking about the good war, and it made me sick seeing the guy talking about it.
Yeah, Brokaw coined that term, the greatest generation.
The greatest, there you go, the greatest generation, yeah, like these Russians. Well, I tell you, we're going to have to take a break right now, and when we come back, we're going to hear more about this, and I'd like to know who was doing this, who gave sanction, get into some more graphic facts. All right, Tom?
Okay.
Folks, we're really looking into this hellstorm, The Death of Nazi Germany by Thomas Goodrich.
I'll be right back after this brief message.
Hello again, friends. This is Tex Mars. You know, Hellstorm is such an important book. If you don't buy any other book this year, buy this book. Order this book. Now, you'll be helping our ministry. Of course, we need income to keep going here. And but the important thing is that you get this book. It's just, how much is this book, Jared? What are we asking for it? $25. Okay, it's $25. It's around 375 pages of very important information. And you know, you just heard Tom Goodrich talk about the ships that were sank, the everything that's going on. He talks about Hitler in his bunker, the Dresden bombing, everything. There's all kinds of pictures. Here's one of this monster, Ilya Ehrenberg, that Tom Goodrich mentioned on the air. Here's another picture of Hamburg, Germany, or what was left of it after the war, of the decimated bodies in Dresden. And, you know, you look at this and you say, how could this be possible? These horrible things really occurred. And, you know, you've heard of the Holocaust, and we're told that 6 million died. Now, you know my views on that. I'm going to save that for, I've already talked about it, but I'm going to save that for another day. This is the real Holocaust. And by the way, Solzhenitsyn, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who was called the conscience of the 20th century, the great Russian writer, he was part of the Russian troops. You know, he was in uniform for the Russians. Of course, he made the mistake of writing a letter which slightly made fun or condemned the communist, and he was arrested himself and spent 10 years in a Soviet gulag. I'm going to ask Mr. Goodrich in a minute about those Soviet gulags, those concentration camps. You may be surprised to discover that on 1945, when Germany surrendered, they did not close down all the concentration camps like you were told. They kept operating them, but this time they brought in Germans. German men, women, children became the prisoners, became the convicts, innocent people. And many of them were brutally starved to death, frozen to death. Maybe millions died. We really don't know how many hundreds of thousands died. Think about that. Millions of Germans died after the war, after Germany was unconditionally defeated. You must have this book. This is a truthful book. This is not propaganda. If you want propaganda, go and take some college course like I used to take. You know, listen, I have the college degrees, and I know all about this history, and I've read all these establishment people. They're cowards. They won't tell you the truth. They cannot tell you the truth. Their books won't be published. I know my books cannot be published. I have to publish my own books, and I do so gladly. It's because I was a number one best-selling author in the Christian world. I had the number one best-selling books, 3 in a row. But my publisher told me, I can't publish this book. You say these things. Allow us to take this out, and we can publish your book. But I said, that's truthful. But my publisher said, well, it doesn't matter whether it's true or not. It cannot be published. I was just talking with a good friend of a Christian ministry out in California. He had a book. The publisher said, take this chapter out. It told about what the Jews had done to the whole world. You've got to take this chapter out. We cannot mention the Jews. Why? He said, I'm telling the truth. They said, again, the same thing. Yes, it's true, but we cannot publish that. It will not get in bookstores. You see, this is the thing. The publishers themselves are in a bind. They can't get their books in bookstores if it mentions things that are not authorized. We do not have a free country. There is no free press. Listen to me, folks. This is as close as you're going to get. Hellstorm. Hellstorm is available, and we're selling it right now in this ministry. If you can't go down to your bookstore and get it, phone us, write us. Here's our phone number, toll-free, 1-800-234-9673, 1-800-234-9673. Or go to our website, powerofprophecy.com, powerofprophecy.com. And there you'll find the book being offered right there on our home page. And order it. You can also send us $25 plus $5 shipping and handling, a total of $30. Ask for the book Hellstorm. Hellstorm by Thomas Goodrich. Just ask for Hellstorm. We'll know what you mean. You can write to us at Power of Prophecy, 1708 Patterson Road, Austin, Texas, 78733. And we'll get the book right to you. We're going to keep this book in print as long as we can. And Mr. Goodrich says he's going to have a supply of them. He told me, and I'm going to ask him again about it, but he told me that this is his life mission, to tell the truth, not to be accepted by the world. Folks, it's too late for that. We're at the end of time now. We don't know how much time we have left. I don't know how much longer this ministry will be here. The internet, they're going to close it down. I tell you, this radio voice, you won't hear it very long after this. I don't know how long. We're blessed right now because we are able to tell you about this book. We're able to offer this book. And I don't care how many people come to visit me. And you know the kind of people I'm talking about, with FBI badges and all this stuff, to shut us down. We don't care, though, because we're going to keep going on. We'll just ask them to have a seat, have a cup of coffee, and, you know, listen to them a while and tell them thank you and goodbye. That's what that's what we've done for, what is it, Jerry? About 20, how many years have we been here? 28 or something? I don't know. See, there, it's so long, I just keep doing it. I don't even know how long it is, but it's over 25 years. And everybody that works here, I don't know why they stay with us, but they do. They're all good people, good Christian folks. They've all been here 20 years, 15 years, 12 years. And my wife, she's even stuck with me. We've been married about 37, 38 years. She's here today in the ministry. And she's in an office right next to mine. Listen, Hellstorm. This is the book you need. I'm recommending it to you. I'm saying that you need this book. I got it accidentally. But I read it and I said, wow, I want this book. By the way, my good friend Joseph Kaminsky wrote an essay the other day on online, and he recommended this book as well. So I think it's just beginning to get out there, and this is the kind of book that will gather steam as you and I talk about it, as we tell others. When we say, hey, you've seen all these Hollywood movies by Tarantino and all these crummy producers. You've seen all these terrible movies that lie. Now read the truth. Get this book in the hands. Have this book prominent on your coffee table at home. Get some friends over. They'll look at it and go, wow, that's an interesting book. They'll thumb through it, and they'll be shocked. Let them borrow it. In fact, you might want to order two books so you can have one as a borrowing copy. Okay, $25 plus $5 shipping and handling for Hellstorm, The Death of Nazi Germany. Now, everyone, as you know, who orders anything from us, a tape of this program today, you can order that for $10 plus $5 shipping as well. Just ask for the Hellstorm CD or audio tape. We will send you, with your order, a free subscription to our newsletter, at least 6 months of our newsletter, Power of Prophecy. Next month, I'm going to have a feature article on this book. So you got to get it. Okay? It's going to be a feature article on this book. Tell you about this book and much, much more. All right. Well, let's return to our regular program. I have with me as my guest, Thomas Goodrich. Mr. Goodrich, you've written a number of books, but would you say, you know, people ask me this all the time, would you say this is perhaps your most important book?
Far and away, Tex, it is. I've written, I think, a dozen books prior to this, and they're good books. They're on the American Civil War, on the Indian Wars, they're on the Abraham Lincoln assassination, they're on the defeat of the South, and what it was like, what that looked like, and it certainly wasn't the Moonlight and Magnolias approach that we've gained throughout the years. But by far, I think this book, you can put all the books together, the other books together, and still, this is the most important book. This is the one that can affect how we view that war, and how we view life today, how we look at the things around us, how the world looks, and what it looks like in the future. I think you can read this book and you can portend the future, actually. That's why I wrote the book, is that this never happens again to anyone, anywhere in the world. That if enough people learn what happened in World War II and realize this was not the good war, it was the worst war, I think if enough people find out about how really terrible it was, that with a unified voice, they'll stand up and say, never again.
Mm.
Never again, not in our name, not in our time will this happen, never again. So that's my hope. It's a lofty hope. But still, that's what keeps me going, is that if we can stop wars like this, well, but let me say this also to your listeners out there. I've got to thank Tex again for having this program, because if it wasn't for people like Tex, you wouldn't be hearing about what this war was all about, the so-called good war. Tex Mars, it's people like him that allow people like me to come on and say what I'm saying. So if you're going to do any shopping anywhere, please do it through Tex, because it helps keep his program on the air, his ministry going. So even though it may not seem to be an appropriate Christmas gift, if you buy this book, buy it through Tex. Don't go to Amazon. Don't go anywhere else. Go through Tex. Let me also say something, Tex, that I haven't mentioned about the book. It would be very easy to kill me, the messenger. I'm just a person. I have my foibles, my flaws, my idiosyncrasies, but it's very hard to kill the message when it's in the words of the people themselves, and that's what this book is. It's a first-person, you-are-their approach to World War II history, what it was like to endure a terror bombing, and hopefully you survived. Tell what it was like to get your children out of a burning city, to tell what it was like to be raped 100 times and survive. And how do you get on with your life after that? It's in the words of the people themselves, and not just necessarily the victims. Sometimes the victimizers are talking in this book, what it was like to do terrible things and laugh about it, and then come back, and hopefully your conscience starts working on you in the next 20 or 30 years, and you feel remorse and regret for what you did. There's a lot of that. For instance, I talk about torture in this book. You know, we've got a lot of torture going on right now in America. In fact, it's seems to be state-sponsored torture that we've got in Gitmo and probably 100 other CIA screen pits around the world. But we got a rolling start, let me tell you, in World War II. G2, intelligence, U.S. Army intelligence, was filled with a lot of Jews who had fled Germany in the 30s, but they came back now with a vengeance, of course, because they not only spoke fluent German, but they understood the German culture, and more especially, they understood the German mind. They made excellent torturers, and that's exactly what they did. For instance, everybody's heard of Nuremberg, the Nuremberg trials. That's where the main Nazis were put on trial. But there were other smaller Nurembergs going on all around Germany. Eisenhower wanted to kill 100,000 Nazis, and they probably did. He was an inveterate hater of Germanism, by the way. And I'll talk about him in just a minute. But in one place, and I forget the name of the town, of the 500 defendants that were brought to trial for war crimes, Nazis that is, 475 had their testicles smashed, destroyed. They're not going to be propagating anymore. They're through. But that's what I mean by torture. So, but let me say this also. The torture that was going on in Germany was vicious, depraved, lining men up, beating them half to death with clubs. Women also got the same treatment. They were raped, of course, in front of large plate glass windows so people could watch the spectacle going on inside. We're not, I'm not just talking about any women. Leni Riefenstahl, maybe the greatest filmmaker of all time, period. She was that good, and still to this very day is good. It's her artistry that was great. She was arrested 7 times after the war, raped every time, beaten, knocked down. Certainly one of the most beautiful and talented women in the world, got the same treatment. But it isn't just one terrible recital after another. I like to get in these little touches, these miracles, if you will, that happen in the midst of hell. For instance, there's this one pathetic German man, I'm not sure if he was a soldier or a politician or even a Nazi, but He had been turned every which way but loose in one of these torture pens at the end of the war by the Americans. And as he was limping back, of course, every bone in his body is just nearly broken or bruised, but he's limping back to his jail cell in this dark dungeon, and he misses his room. And so the American guard gives him a swift kick in the butt and kicks him into his cell. And the man had made up his mind after this most recent torture fest that he was going to kill himself. He stopped believing in God, and he had hidden a razor, and he was going to take his own life that evening. But just before he could open his veins, his cell door cracked ever so slightly, and he could see in the little bit of light, it was an American soldier creeping in. And the American soldier put his fingers to his lips, signifying shh, shh. And then he said, "I saw what happened." In other words, he saw that soldier kick him into the cell. And what the little guy did was pull out several boiled potatoes and put them in the man's hands. And then he left. Without further ado, he left. But that's what I mean by miracles in the midst of hell. The man lived out his life. He did not kill himself, obviously. But he broke down utterly because it was so unexpected. There's other accounts. For instance, a man I interviewed personally across his breakfast table up in Kansas City one day while I was writing this book, he mentions all German soldiers were slaves. If they were in the German or the Russian sector after the war was over, they were turned into instant slaves. They were sent to Siberia, the gulags, the mines, the forests, the swamps, to do the bidding of the Soviet Union. And he was only a kid when he was caught. He was 16, but it was when he was about 20, and he had just become everything but a human, it seemed, at that point, from overwork and disease. And he was standing there slaving, and this old babushka, which is a Russian grandmother, all bent and crippled over, saw him standing there, and she was probably on her way to church, but she saw him, and she walked over to him, and she made the sign of the cross over him, and then handed him a couple of coins, probably a ruble or two, and a tear came down her cheek, her weathered cheek, and she walked away. That was it, but it kept that young man alive, that there was still some humanity left, someone who could show compassion and love in the midst of this hell. So I love to get those little things in to show that not everybody is utterly depraved and savage and sadistic. But for the most part, unfortunately, this is a, Tex, I'm just dominating the conversation here.
It's your book. Well, you have important things to say. I'm just thinking about the Americans. I mean, you have many horrible stories about what Americans did. Of course, we know that Eisenhower herded these hundreds of thousands, even millions of Germans. They disarmed the Germans, and then rather than letting them go back to their homes peacefully, they put them in these horrible concentration camps with the barbed wire, and they lived, most of them lived out in the open. And with the weather and such, I mean, in no time at all, there was one, I think, that was like 125,000 Germans there. And within 3 months, only 25,000 were alive. 100,000 died of 125,000. As far as the food goes, you say in your book here that they made it a punishable offense for an American soldier to give food to these people, these poor people. And all they really had was, you know, feces-filled, watery soup quite often.
You know, Tex, that was a double blow for me. I'm from Kansas. I was born in Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
That, of course, is Eisenhower's home state. And I grew up loving Eisenhower. My parents were solid Republicans. We were proud of Eisenhower.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a double blow when I found out that he's one of the greatest mass murderers in world history. Eisenhower was a death general. He never heard a bullet fired in anger. He made it his mission that once the war was over, he was going to kill as many more Germans as he possibly could. So like you say, yes, Germany was a signatory, just like America, of the Geneva Convention, and that's supposed to guarantee the life and safety of anybody who falls into your hands, a prisoner. Well, Eisenhower, with a sleight of hand, basically, a little legerdemain, if you will, designated the Germans that he had in his control after the war, not as POWs, but as DEFs, disarmed enemy forces. And that, in his mind at least, got him away from the scrutiny of the Red Cross, who administered the Geneva Convention, and the world at large. Under his control, anywhere from 800,000 to 1.5 million helpless, disarmed German soldiers died. They died from starvation, even though the International Red Cross in Switzerland wanted to bring in trainload after trainload of food to feed these dying men. Eisenhower forbade it. He would not allow food trains to enter his camps. Other men died in his camps. They died from dehydration, from lack of water. They died from thirst, for God's sakes. And many of the camps were parked right beside the Rhine River. You had this Rhine River. Can you imagine what kind of torment that was to men who are dying of thirst to see the river flowing beside? Men actually drank their own urine before they died, of course. You've got men dying from the elements. The elements in the spring in Germany when the war ended is very rainy. And, of course, you're out in the open. It's nothing but mud. It's mud mixed with feces and urine and vomit and dying people and blood. And that's the element you're living in. You're slopping around. You're digging out a hole to try to find some shelter at night. You're crawling in with 5 and 10 other guys to try to stay warm. And guess what? If the guards weren't spraying the camps with machine gun fire for the heck of it, for kicks, you better be listening very well, because bulldozers will come in and bulldoze your holes, trying to keep the place clean, they said, and try to create more space for more soldiers to die on. Yes, that was a kick in the groin when I realized that this man, this fellow that I always had the best feeling for Eisenhower. I just simply liked the way he looked as a president. Was one of the world's greatest mass murderers. There's no other way to cut it. Of course, FDR, in my opinion, is probably certainly the greatest American mass murderer for what he did, goading the Japanese to attack at Pearl Harbor. But that's another matter altogether. And so when I talk about hellstorm, there is no word in the English language, no single word that can describe the enormity of what I describe in this book. But hellstorm is the closest I could find. We're touching upon some various crimes. As I think by now the listeners understand that we're not talking about a single crime. We're not talking about just terror bombing or Eisenhower's slaughter of 800,000 to 1.5 million helpless German soldiers. We're not talking just about the egregious, vile rape of German womanhood. There's more than that. And we're not just talking about the torture. And you mentioned earlier about the torture pens over in the Soviet zone in Poland. Yes, they were manned mostly by Jewish people who had got out of the camps, or who had probably come in from Russia to administer these camps. And it's hard to say where the, you know, in a book that's just full of revelations and terrible revelations, this may well be the most demonic, disgusting, evil aspect of the whole book was what went on in those torture pens, those torture camps. These were not, the object in these camps was not to move death along, it was to prolong death, to torture as long as you could possibly do it. Death was something to be avoided. And it's so revolting to even think about. Of all parts in the book that I've read from time to time, that's the one I studiously avoid. I just got an email today from somebody who had bought the book and was telling me about it. And they were mentioning this thing that I'm talking about right now, the torture pin. And he said, I didn't know humans were capable of such a thing. And I've got to say, I didn't either. I've been around, Tex. Like I said, we're about the same age. So we've seen and heard a lot of things, but nothing that approaches this.
But Tom, I mean, this was not in wartime. This was peacetime. This is when, you know, we had, there was no resistance. There was no fighting. This was, we had conquered these people and forced them into an unconditional surrender. And then we went in and killed millions of unarmed people. I mean, this is unbelievable. that we actually killed millions of unarmed men, women, and children. We froze them to death. We tortured many to death. We starved them to death. We beat them to death. We raped many to death. And we are responsible as Americans. We need to do what's right and admit these, to confess these. Now, I want to emphasize that many American fighting men did not know this. They simply were drafted. They went over. They did their duty. Many did not even know these things were going on. And I believe that many fighting men that belong to this ministry will read your book, and they did not know these things themselves. But they'll be sickened when they see that they were part of something, just like Vietnam, Korea, Afghanistan, and Iraq. Many of they're talking about so many killing themselves. American fighting men coming back from Afghanistan and Iraq and killing themselves, knowing what they were required to do, what they were forced to do. So, I mean, I want to say that not every American, by any means, you know, there's probably only about 5% of all the people in the world who are psychopaths. That's a huge number. Think about that. If only 5% of the American fighting people did these terrible crimes, and if those 5% were in leadership positions like Eisenhower, wow, what horrible things they could do. And they kept it from us. The press did not report this. Everything was censored, and we got, well, let me ask you about George Patton. We only have a few minutes here. Now, Bill O'Reilly of O'Reilly Factor on Fox News has written this book. Totally, you know, it doesn't mention the word the Jews, throughout. But we know what George Patton, General Patton, thought about the Jews. Who killed George Patton? He wanted to put a stop to many of these things, did he not?
I'm not an expert on that. I know what you're saying, though, and yes, he had many times, time and time again, he mentions them in his diaries and the letters about the Semitic influence in the army right now doing terrible work in Europe, killing off the best people, the Germans, that is. But my problem with Patton is, yes, he was a good general. Why did this epiphany take so long? Why couldn't he have come right out at the beginning of the war saying, I'm not going to be any part of this. I know exactly what's going to happen. I'm not going to do it. So that's my problem with Patton. However, even at that late state, when the war is over, him making those comments was still a very honorable thing for him to do. And yes, I think he probably was assassinated.
Yeah.
That happens when you try to spill the beans like that.
Right. They didn't want him to come back to the United States. It's sort of like the NFL football star that went in the Army, Pat Tillman. They weren't going to allow him to come back from Afghanistan and tell the American people what was really going on there. So they murdered him. They murdered Pat Tillman. David Petraeus, all these generals, they're all a bunch of, we're about to run out of time here, Tom.
Okay. Well, you can have me back anytime. There's a ton of things we could talk about. Maybe not all quite so depressing as this. The book, although we're hitting some of the more desperate and despairing incidents, there's still some things in here that I'd never heard about, and I think the readers would also like to hear about. And like I said, I'd be happy to come back anytime, Tex.
All right. Well, you've done a great service with this book, Tom, and I really appreciate it. And I know our readers, our listeners, do as well. Hellstorm, The Death of Nazi Germany, 1944 to 47. Get this book, friends. Get it. Phone us toll-free, 1-800-234-9673. Go to powerofprophecy.com. Tom Goodrich, thank you for coming on the program today.
It's been my pleasure, Tex. Thank you so much.
Really appreciate it. All right. Well, friends, until next time, this is Tex Mars inviting you to tune in each week during this same time and discover the power of prophecy.